So, you will be coming to Europe one of these days, I suppose.
Yes, I get to Brussels. When do I get to Brussels? Let's see. Next Wednesday morning, I arrive.
I see, and you stay in our country for some time, I see, because on Thursday you are expected here in Antwerp at the Roma. But I just saw that you will also be attending Manifiesta.
Yeah, so I'm staying till Monday and then flying back on Monday on the 15th of September.
Okay. I was just wondering if maybe you would travel on to other countries in Europe. It's
No, I'm just going to be in Belgium for those few days.
okay. And just to talk a bit about you, so you were born in London,
Yes.
but you moved to the United States at a certain point.
I moved to the United States in 2010.
And that was to work at a university or?
No, I moved because I had a I was commissioned to do a research project in the United States looking at how counterterrorism policies were affecting Muslim communities in the United States. So I spent a year kind of traveling around the United States doing that research, and then after that I wanted to stay in the United States, so I found a way to do that, and I ended up living here permanently.
I see. So you were looking for how anti-terrorism was affecting Muslim.
Yeah, I wrote a book. I wrote a book that came out in 2014, which was called The Muslims Are Coming, and that book was basically the outcome of that research project that I did. It was kind of the end of 2010 and the beginning and the first half of 2011. So that book was it basically it was really the looking at the ways that on the one hand, it was looking at the ways that different government agencies investigated terrorism and extremism within the United States. So, a lot of the interviews I did were with FBI agents and people like that, people in the Department of Homeland Security, local law enforcement departments, but then so it told that story, but then also it told the story from the point of view of Muslim communities, like how they experienced that and the kind of anti-Muslim racism that came with that. So I looked at how that was playing out in about five or six different places in the United States. So I spent some time doing research in Dearborn, Michigan, and in Texas, and in Minnesota, New York, and so on.
Do you think such research would still be possible these days?
Well, that research has always been hard to do. I was doing that research in the sort of period when there was still the period I was doing that research was when the war on terror had it, the war on terror had its kind of first 8 or so years under the Bush administration. But then when I was doing the research, it was under Obama, but the war on terror continued in new forms, right? And one of the ways that the war on terror developed was that it began to focus much more domestically on what they called Islamic radicalization within the United States. And so there was certainly very there was I mean no one else was really looking at that issue from a critical point of view. And certainly it was still very much in that kind of post 9/11 period when you were supposed to just have one thing to say about the subject, which was, you know, that all terrorists are evil and you're either with us or you're against them. Right.
Be a good patriot.
Right. Exactly. So that climate, I mean, that climate, you know, there are the current climate under this second Trump administration. I don't view it as a drastic break with everything that's come before in the United States. I a lot of the building blocks for what we're seeing now were already there for a long time. So, and you see that with the war on terror very clearly, right? A lot of the machinery that the Trump administration is using right now for its authoritarian repression of Muslims, of pro-Palestinian activists, of migrants, a lot of that machinery was set up in the war on terror.
I always had the impression it was even set up before and waiting for some occasion to be put into practice, because they talk about a war on terror, but what they call terror, isn't it rather a reaction on what was the US policy before that? So
that would be true if you think about the international context, right? That you can trace it's best to kind of say that there's quite a lot of complexity around that history in terms of the cause and effect there, right? Like, so for example, I don't personally think that it's simply, it's too simple a story, I think, for us to say, you know, the US empire repressed people and then people responded with terrorism, right? Mm-hmm. And I'm not arguing that. I think there is definitely a causal relationship between US imperialism and those forms of violence emerging. But it's a complex one, because, you know, if you think about, so for example, certainly in the case of the aftermath of the Iraq invasion in 2003, it's pretty obvious that a whole load of groups around the world who up to that point had either never been involved in violence, or they had not been involved in violence directed at the United States. They might have been involved in some kind of local insurgency, but the decision to invade Iraq at that point in 2003, you know, was the reason that a lot of those groups then decided to get involved in violence against the United States or against the West in general. So, and that's certainly what explains, for example, the Madrid bombing in 2004 and the London bombing in 2005. I mean, it's a fairly direct relationship. But taking a step back historically, you know, I don't think you can say, I mean, if you look at 9/11, for example, so there, what you have is people who are really former allies of the United States, right? It's so 9/11 is not as simple as, you know, Muslims angry at American imperialism, therefore they carry out this attack. What it really is, you know, Osama bin Laden fought with the Americans. He fought with the CIA in Afghanistan against the Soviet Union, right?
Yes, and they did.
And he's a product of the Saudi ruling class, which again is an ally of the United States. He had relationships with the Pakistani ruling class, which again is an ally of the United States, right? Mm-hmm. So these are not simply anti-imperialists. these are people who have a very different relationship to US imperialism than, you know, the classical kind of anti-imperialists of whatever generation you want to think about, you know, whether you're talking about Che Guevara or whether you're talking about the Sandinistas or whoever, right? This is something very different, and there's a complex history here, and I think that's important. But certainly within the United States, after 9/11, you know, one of the things that happens is there is an entire new government department that is created called the Department of Homeland Security, right? That's one of the things that happens after 9/11. Now, if you look at what entity right now is carrying out the most repressive measures in the United States in terms of domestically, in terms of the what I think of as the ethnic cleansing of migrants from the United States, that's the Department of Homeland Security, and it has the ability and the capacity to do that because it has received billions and billions and billions of dollars of funding from both political parties. You know, in the 20 or so years that it's been in existence, right? And it's had the legislative powers that have given it this capacity for repression, passed, again, bipartisan, right? By both political parties. So you know, what Trump is really about, to me, is he is making explicit in his rhetoric and in his policymaking things that were implicit already in the war on terror, in the war on drugs, in the war on migration, that, and these wars were bipartisan projects, you know, going back decades.
And here he is really in your face, very blatantly, Right.
But you know, right now, the question of, you see, what we aren't doing a very good job of understanding this question of migration in the United States right now, right? So if you think about, so the prevailing way that it's understood is hatred, right? There are people in the United States who have a kind of hatred of immigrants, perhaps motivated by patriotism or racism or whatever, and they have voted for Trump to get rid of the immigrants, and so then he is doing that very violently. That's just, to me, that's just not an adequate explanation of what's going on. We need to look at the question of what do borders do for capitalism, and what do migrant workers do within capitalism?
So more in terms of who is benefiting from what's happening now.
Yes, exactly. I think so.
As with any crime.
But also, you know, so if you think about, you see, the United States is, people in Europe sometimes don't have a clear picture of this because it's a little different from Europe. But in the United States, there are millions and millions and millions of workers in the United States who live in the United States, pay taxes in the United States, but have no immigration status, right? They're undocumented in terms of immigration, right? And so what that enables for employers is obviously a cheap labor force, because if you're it's super exploitation, because if you are undocumented and you try and organize in your workplace, you're very vulnerable. And you know what happens is someone calls the authorities and you're deported, right? So so this is a workforce that can, that is segregated from the rest of the working class in the United States on the basis of race, right? It has a separate regime of denial of rights. It is disempowered. It is super exploited, right? That is hugely profitable to capitalism. The border enables that that racial segregation, and it enables that super exploitation. But what the border also does is it means that, like, if you think about the border with Mexico, you know, on one side of that border, you have, so, you know, you have one of the, you have the richest country in the world on one side of the border, and a, and on the other side of the border, you have workplaces where, for the same work that's done in the United States, in Mexico, that work can be done with wage costs that are one fifth of what they are in the United States, right? So if you have a border and you and a a multinational corporation that has a manufacturing plant in the United States crosses that border, relocates to the Mexican side of the border, it can cut its wage costs by one fifth, mm-hmm. right? To one fifth of what it was, right? And so the border enables that, because if it wasn't for the border, that wage differential wouldn't be possible. And what's more, that border is a racialized border, right? It defines it's an infrastructure of racial difference. It's a infrastructure of racial segregation, right? Mm-hmm. It's as absolute and violent as the racial segregation that, you know, that historically existed in the United States under the Jim Crow system, or the racial segregation that existed under apartheid in South Africa. And like those other historical examples, it is functional to capitalism, right? It enables capitalists to make much more money, right? So, mm-hmm.
To set people against each other.
Well, even it, you know, I think on the left, we like to tell a story sometimes where we say, really, you know, the white worker and the non-white worker have the same interest in overthrowing capitalism, and the capitalists try and pit these workers against yes. each other in order to mm-hmm. divide them, right? And we like this story, right? Mm-hmm. We like this story, and there's an element of truth to it. But I think sometimes what we miss when we emphasize that story too much is that in particular contexts, white workers and other workers actually don't have the same interests, right? Like, because the difference between the white worker and the other worker is not just ideological, it's also material, right? Like, the undocumented worker just doesn't have anything like the material, the access to,
yes.
the access to material well-being, mm-hmm. access to has a completely different regime of rights. They are subjected to a separate regime of policing, right? Mm-hmm. So they don't. That it is, you know, it is unrealistic to imagine that there is some kind of natural unity waiting to mm-hmm. be discovered beneath that. Right, like that's the fantasy that sometimes historically on the left, on the white left, I should say, that has been there, right? It sounds nice and hopeful, but the reality is that unity, you know, it can be made under certain circumstances, in certain circumstances, we certainly find that in history, right? That those workers come together in a unified struggle.
Yes, but it's when the pressure is too high on both groups from the same source.
Well, I don't think it's not necessarily about the pressure. I think it's more about the quality of the political organizing, for example, that mm-hmm. is being done by workers' organizations, right? And the choices they're making actually is I think a bigger factor than the external pressures. But in any case, what I'm saying is that can happen sometimes. But we, when it does happen, it's not something that is, it's not happening because that is the kind of underlying truth of the system. It's happening because a political project has successfully created it.
Consciously.
And equally, right, and at other times, completely valid political projects will organize those migrant workers as a separate class. As a separate mm-hmm. fraction of the working class.
And is that happening in the United States? Is there any organizing?
I mean, right now in the United States, you know, if you want to see working class struggle in the United States in 2025, look at what is happening in California
yes.
with undocumented migrant workers, right? The most powerful resistance to the Trump administration has come from them, and they've basically defeated. You know, the Trump administration had a plan to roll out this very aggressive deportation program, mm-hmm. which they tried to do first in California, mm-hmm. and they were defeated this summer, right? They were defeated by the mass resistance that emerged in Los Angeles in particular, right?
And who is opposing? That's not
well.
Just...
We're talking about, you know, predominantly Mexican undocumented workers who've mm-hmm. all got who have some level of organization in particular neighborhoods that was mobilized to defeat the attempts to
yes
remove them en masse,
because
right?
they
Now,
had been there some time, so they had time to build a network or an organization or and that happened actually.
There are organizations. There are organizations. So the but that struggle and those organizations are not really linking those workers politically to other certainly not to white workers in the United States, right? So it's an autonomous struggle. Understood by the people involved in it as a class struggle and an anti-racist struggle at the same time.
But is there also a solidarity from the legal workers organizations?
There's all kinds of there's all kinds of solidarity going on. There's organizations that are involved in immigrant rights campaigning, right? Some of which is around legal representation, some of which is around other kinds of organizing work. So there's that kind of sector, if you like, of NGOs. There's a certain amount of and obviously there is, to some extent, there is a organized left in the United States. And those organizations are active on these issues as well. But I don't think any of that adds up to a picture in which you can say that there is a broad-based kind of working class solidarity around this issue. It's more that there is an autonomous struggle that, if it has a grassroots, that grassroots is pretty much restricted to the migrant communities themselves.
So do you think they stand a chance to counterbalance what's happening now?
Well, I think that depends on what happens next in terms of their initiative, but also more broadly, the so-called resistance to Trump in the United States. So I think obviously the left in the United States is relatively small. It doesn't have political power. It doesn't have a great deal of mass support. What you have in much larger numbers and much more powerful politically is a kind of vaguely liberal constituency, right? That is represented through the Democratic Party, that has a wing of the establishment that it aligns with. And so the political question of like what happens to this confrontation between the Trump administration and the migrant communities that he's targeting, really it's the question of what is the position of the Democrats in this, and the kind of liberal constituency in the United States. And on that, they have, in some ways they are taking a stand that I think actually if you compare it to Europe, it would be surprising. Like, so for example, in California, there is a proposal right now for the state government, right, the Californian state government, to have legislation that would create a kind of early warning system for the schools in California, so that when agents of the federal government are coming to those schools to carry out an immigration raid, that there is a warning, and the people who might be affected by that are able to escape.
Are they raiding schools?
Oh yes, they're raiding schools. So if you imagine an equivalent situation in Europe, I think that would be hard to. So in Europe, it would be hard to imagine a regional government passing legislation that seeks to make the central government's immigration policy ineffective, right? But that's what you can see in the United States. So there's something there that I think to a European audience is interested, right? But on the other hand, if you look at the kind of mainstream of the Democratic Party, and if you look at the mainstream of the kind of demonstrations that have been organized in the United States to oppose Trump, you know, that have brought millions of people to the streets, this so-called No Kings demonstrations, right? Which, yes, through the summer, millions of people participated in them. And they are meant to be, you know, sending a message that, you know, lots of people in the United States are opposed to what Trump is doing. Now, if you look at them, nowhere there actually is there an understanding that the largest mass movement in the United States over the last 18 months or so, on the left, has been the pro-Palestinian movement, right? And that if you want to bring people onto the streets in large numbers to counter Trump, and if you want that to, you know, if you want to have political energy, and if you want to feel like you're on the move, building something that's really going to have some power, you can't do that while trying to exclude and alienate from your project the largest mass mobilization from the left in the last 18 months, right? It's insane. It's insane. And it's done. And that is obviously done simply because of a fear that power brokers who are Zionists will not support you if you do that. So they've chosen to align themselves with a particular set of power brokers rather than with the people, right? Because there's, you know, it again, you know, huge numbers of people were involved in the pro-Palestinian mobilization, right? So there's a sort of self-destructiveness from the leaders of these entities, whether it's the No Kings movement or whether it's the Democratic Party leadership, right? There's a self-destructiveness where they choose to align with power interests rather than with the people's interests, and that's why they keep losing, right? And so in that situation, what you have is you have a you know, these kind of popular mobilizations that spring up, like the resistance in Los Angeles to the immigration raids, like the Palestinian mobilizations, you know, mobilizing millions of people to be on the streets, to be challenging the system. Often these are more or less spontaneous, organized through social media, perhaps, but not with deep long-term organization. And then these mobilizations look to the political system to be represented, and they're blocked. Right?
Because so
there's no long-term kind of absorption of these movements into political representation, and therefore we get into this kind of stalemate, right? There's a crisis of political representation. We now can, you know, in this period of political history in the United States, there are multiple issues on which some event can happen, and it will trigger, through social media, quick organizing, it can trigger us to get millions of people on the streets. Whether it was, you know, George Floyd being murdered in 2020, or whether it is Palestine, or whether it is Trump getting elected, we can bring millions of people onto the streets, but then we don't know how to then turn that into some kind of permanent political organization or infrastructure that enables us to actually start winning some of our demands, right? That's where we get stuck. And it's we get stuck because we, in the past, have always expected that the Democratic Party would be the vehicle for us to get those demands implemented. And now it certainly is not that vehicle. And so we're scrambling around what an alternative might be, but we don't have the answers to that, right? And so that's our impasse. That's not yet. That's our impasse in the United States, really, politically.
So you're not considering moving back to London then? No.
Well, you know, I moved from a dead empire to a dying empire. So I think I'm
okay.
I'm you know, I'm not going to move back to the dead empire.
Okay, I'm afraid that our time is up already. So you
Okay.
will be talking about your last book in the Roma and also on Manifiesta, which is about different kinds of anti-racism and why the mainstream form is not effective. And well, I think we had a very interesting talk about what's happening where you live now in the dying
Yeah.
empire.
Yes, absolutely.
And when people want to hear about your book, so I can advise them to go to the Roma on Thursday evening or go to Manifiesta, and you will be on there three times, I see. You will represent your book and you will be in two debates.
Yes, that's right.
Yes, also about resistance in the dying empire.
Correct.
Okay, so thank you for your time.
All right. Thank you. Bye.
Bye.